Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Amy Goodman returns with more stories of ordinary people who increased our democracy and freedom. I hope you'll stay tuned. Amy Goodman spoke in Chicago on June 26, 2014. Her speech was titled "The Silenced Majority: Stories of Uprisings, Resistance, Occupations, and Hope." The stories are about fairly ordinary people who did some extraordinary things that made our world a better place. By and large, inspiring stories of individuals who made a difference is not my favorite genre of literature. In many cases, it's just corporate propaganda. Quote, "Joe Schmo lost both legs in a workplace accident and then lost his job. But he didn't go crying to the government for welfare. No, he pulled himself up by his own bootstraps, founded a very successful business making cookies, and now lives in a $5 million home and drives a new Lexus SUV. Joe is living proof that you can be anything you want to be if you work hard and believe in yourself." Unquote. As I said, not my favorite genre of literature. And on Sunday mornings, Parade magazine goes directly from my front porch to my recycle bin. But Amy's stories of individuals who made a difference are different. The heroes and heroines don't get rich in the end. In fact, their lives often take a turn for the worse. That's true of the heroes and heroines of today's installment: Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, and three Al Jazeera journalists imprisoned in Egypt for telling the truth. Two more of today's heroes have so far gotten off easier: journalists Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald. And what's really interesting is the way Goodman shows that their stories are all connected. Here again is Amy Goodman.
That's what Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, what Edward Snowden represent. Dissent that will save this country. What Glenn and Laura did, and what Edward Snowden did, this 29-year-old intelligence analyst, who wasn't so low-level, by the way, but was succeeding in every way in the establishment. He was training analysts at the Defense Intelligence Agency. He was going overseas. He worked for the CIA. He worked for the National Security Agency. He was a contractor with Dell. He was a contractor with Booz Allen Hamilton. He came to realize that he was understanding things that he felt, if Americans knew, they would feel is wrong. And I dare say our news headline today, that was headlines everywhere today, can be ultimately attributed to what Edward Snowden did a year ago. What was the big headline that came out yesterday? The Supreme Court says warrants needed to search cell phones. Let me read part of the decision. "Modern cell phones are not just another technological convenience. With all they contain and all they may reveal, they hold for many Americans the privacies of life. The fact that technology now allows an individual to carry such information in his hand does not make the information any less worthy to the protection for which the founders fought." Who wrote that? The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Justice John Roberts. And he was writing not for the majority, but for the unanimous 9-0 decision that came down yesterday that we have a right to privacy. And I dare say that this might not have been the same decision if Edward Snowden had not done what he did a year ago. Who knew? You knew certain things, you feared lots of things, but who laid it out as completely as this young 29-year-old who started to see, as this computer analyst, intelligence analyst, he could read the emails of the President of the United States, and he said, something's wrong with this. I was always shocked afterwards by the politicians and pundits, often journalists on television. One of the politicians, a Congress member, I think he was from my state, New York, who said, who does this guy think he is? He is a high school dropout. And all I could think is, doesn't that concern you that a high school dropout can read the email of the President of the United States? Now, if Edward Snowden had just said this, do you think anyone would have believed him? I mean, remember Intelligence Chief Clapper, you know, being questioned by Ron Wyden, the senator, when he said, are you spying on the American people, essentially? And he said no, and then had to backtrack and said, I gave the least untruthful answer I could give. President Obama himself saying this was not true. They force young people like Edward Snowden to get the documents. Because if it was just Edward Snowden's words, or just saying, trust me, I saw this with my own eyes, it never would have been enough. And how could Edward Snowden, as so many have said, why didn't he just bring it to Congress? Really? Why didn't he release it in the United States? Well, Snowden has said he didn't care if he was in jail for the rest of his life, but what he feared was that if he was jailed, he never could get this information out. Think about the time he did this. Edward Snowden, when he did this, he was making his decision at the time of the trial of Chelsea Manning. Chelsea Manning, whose voice we did not hear for 3 years, once he released the documents he did as an intelligence analyst in the desert in Iraq. Also, think about that. I mean, I think worse for the U.S. government was simply the embarrassment that this young intelligence officer in Iraq in the desert could get access to the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war diary, all of these thousands, hundreds of thousands of documents written by low-level soldiers, top-level officers, and the State Department cables going back decades at a computer station in the desert in Iraq, all of it, and put it out in Lady Gaga CDs and get it out to WikiLeaks. That's what he was convicted of. This is what Edward Snowden saw, is what happened to Chelsea Manning, that we could not hear her voice throughout that whole period of his incarceration. She continues to be. We're talking about a sentence of 35 years. Snowden saw what the stakes were. It was right before him. And so he leaves for Hong Kong. And he gets in touch before with Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald. And they meet with him in Hong Kong. I mean, you think about the bravery. Think about who just won the Pulitzer Prize. I mean, Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras won that prize. But technically, the establishment awarded it to The Guardian, where Glenn Greenwald worked, and to the Washington Post, because they both produced all of these stories. The Guardian, most of them written by Glenn Greenwald, and Laura Poitras also wrote for The Guardian and for the Washington Post, so they were part of the body of the work. Their names should have been mentioned when the Pulitzer Prizes were, where the Pulitzer Prizes were given. But The Washington Post chose not to go to Hong Kong, right? The biggest institution that has the biggest backing. And the people who have the most to lose, these individuals, they decide whatever is at stake, they're going to make their way there. They didn't even know who this person was. Was this person old? Was this person young? Was this person a man? Was this person a woman? Was no idea. Was this person real? And they went. And so they met. Now, Glenn Greenwald before being a journalist, was a litigator, and still, even meeting him, question him for hour after hour after hour, is this guy the real deal? And when he became convinced of this, he and Laura interviewed Edward Snowden, Laura, fantastic filmmaker, and they put this video out. And they understood, as they did this series of interviews with him, at any point he could be captured. And then he had to figure out what to do. And this goes to the issue of whether he is a Chinese spy or then a Russian spy. Right? He decides that if he can make his way to Latin America, where he would be offered political asylum, perhaps in Ecuador, in Venezuela, he could be safe. But how does he get there? So he does get on a plane. And with whose help does he get on the plane? And this is very important. WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. Julian Assange, who's just passed his second year of captivity in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He cannot step foot outside the Ecuadorian embassy in Britain, or he will be arrested and extradited to Sweden, because Sweden wants him for questioning around two sexual assault allegations. Now, I'm very clear in saying allegations, and I deeply care about the issue of rape and sexual assault. But it is extremely important to understand that Julian Assange has not even been indicted, let alone convicted. Now, indicted does not mean you're guilty, but it means there's perhaps some evidence. The country of Sweden has not even garnered the evidence to indict him, let alone convict him, yet he has been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy because he was granted political asylum by Ecuador, but can't get to Ecuador because Britain will arrest him and extradite him to Sweden. He's been held there for 2 years, and people are getting antsy. One of the top cops in Britain said, "What are we doing, spending millions of pounds keeping this man holed up when the country that wants him hasn't even indicted him?" So it's very important to get a sense of how the climate may be changing even there. And why does Julian Assange care about going to Sweden? He said if he could be sure he was just going to Sweden, he said he is more than willing to be questioned by Swedish authorities. They could come to the Ecuadorian embassy and he would answer their questions, but they won't. He's scared because he's afraid that Sweden might not be the final destination, that he would then be extradited to the United States. Does Chelsea Manning ring a bell? Does Guantanamo ring a bell? These are very serious issues. And yet from his position, holed up in this embassy, under siege of two of the most powerful countries in the world, Britain and the United States, he is able to make contact with Edward Snowden and with Sarah Harrison, who is part of WikiLeaks. She goes to Hong Kong and they facilitate his departure from Hong Kong. If you ever thought individuals cannot make a difference. So here they are with Edward Snowden. He tries to get to Latin America. So he is transiting through Russia. They're just going to land, refuel, and he'll make his way. Except that the U.S. pulls his passport when he leaves Hong Kong. This is a fact that the media in the United States seems conveniently to forget, as if his final destination was Russia. And he ends up, as you know, in the transit area of the Russian airport for something like 5 weeks. And then finally, he is granted political asylum. What happens next, we will only see. He has applied for political asylum in Brazil. I thought it was interesting during the World Cup, but with the frenzy of the World Cup, and I'm sure many of you were watching, I don't know how many people were paying attention to the fact that Vice President Joe Biden went down to meet with Dilma Rousseff and say that we're going to give you a lot of the archives of the coups that took place in Brazil. And this is of serious interest to her and the people of Brazil. You know, she herself was imprisoned in Brazil, the president of Brazil. She was tortured. She was a guerrilla. She was a freedom fighter. They want all this information. The U.S. sadly complicit in the coasters in Brazil. Very interesting. In the middle of the World Cup, the vice president of the United States should go down to Brazil and say, we're going to make these archives available to you. Did it have anything to do with putting pressure on this country not to grant political asylum to Edward Snowden. Now, I don't know, and I'm not going to say that that is what Joe Biden was doing. I often don't understand Joe Biden, but maybe it was the same reason why Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to Sweden right at the time that Julian Assange was supposed to be extradited, and the Attorney General, Eric Holder, also went to Sweden. Neither an Attorney General sitting or a Secretary of State had been to Sweden. And yet, this is all happening now. Yes, what Edward Snowden has revealed to us has changed the world. And doing it through journalists, the importance of journalists. He said, I'm not there to expose everything, to blow the lid and expose people's identities. I want journalists to carefully review this, to decide what should go out. What I want to do is, he said, I'm not even there for social change. I am there to give Americans information so they can decide what they want their country to be. Do we want a national surveillance state? And that is what Edward Snowden continues to attempt from Russia. And what Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras are committed to, getting you this information so that you can make up your minds. Their bravery is unparalleled. When you think of all they risk, I could not believe a few weeks ago I was at a Midtown hotel in New York City. At a big celebration of one of the biggest awards in journalism, the George Polk Awards. And hundreds of journalists were there, and Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald were going to get this award. They hadn't been in the United States for 10 months since they had begun to reveal the information that Edward Snowden had availed to them, all of these documents. I mean, you think about what the politicians were saying, that Glenn Greenwald is a thief, he should be arrested immediately, that these people were guilty of espionage. Can you believe that they were being brave just to come into the United States? And yet, we didn't know as we sat in this hotel with the rubber chickens and everything, whether Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald would be arrested at the airport. I mean, Laura had been stopped some 40 times over the last years. But this time was the most serious. But they decided they would risk this because it was so important to speak directly to the American people. And they came in and they made it to the middle of the ceremony. And it was astounding. And 3 days later, the Pulitzer Prizes were announced. And even if they didn't make note of Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, I think it has everything to do with resentment about what they have done, to resentment about new media versus old media. But the fact is that both of them have won this Pulitzer Prize for their old media institutions, for these large newspapers that they and the newspapers themselves and the websites, The Guardian and Washington Post, certainly know it is because of them that these awards were granted to them. But it's much bigger than any particular award. The greatest honor is that they're changing the conversation in this country and our awareness. President Obama says, we were going to have this conversation anyway. I hardly think so. And so I want to end on 2 points. Journalism and journalists are under siege. We see it in this country, certainly when it comes to the journalists who are revealing how our country is changing. The secrets of an increasingly secret government, a powerful government that has more information about individuals than ever in history, and yet is becoming increasingly secret itself. But it's not only in the United States we have to be concerned. I want to address what's happening in Egypt right now that actually is directly connected to the United States. The three Al Jazeera journalists who have just been sentenced to these draconian prison terms, you know, Mohamed Fahmy, Bahar Mohamed, and Peter Gresta, they were arrested. They were accused of conspiracy with the Muslim Brotherhood because they were interviewing the Muslim Brotherhood. The sentences were announced. They came down on Monday. On Sunday, Secretary of State John Kerry was meeting with el-Sisi, the new president, the former general of Egypt. And John Kerry was there to resume military aid to Egypt the day before the verdicts came down. When the verdicts were handed down in the court on Monday against Mohammed and Fahmy and Gresta and three other journalists in absentia, Mohammed Fahmy shouted from his cage in the courtroom, "Where is John Kerry?" John Kerry had flown on to Iraq, but the weapons flow was continuing. Amnesty International said about these prisoners, calling on people around the world to appeal to President Sisi, writing, "All three men are prisoners of conscience, imprisoned solely for peaceful exercise of their right to free expression. Egypt must immediately drop the charges against the three journalists and let them go free." But not all voices calling for freedom are equal. Fahmy and Gresta got 7 years. Bahar Mohammed got 10. Why? Because he had a shell casing. They said he was in possession of ammunition. How many journalists pick up these shells in conflict areas, not just as souvenirs, but also to prove, for example, origin, where ammunition comes from? So he got an extra 3 years pinned on. Egypt is one of the largest recipients of U.S. aid, averaging $1.5 billion to $2 billion per year since 1979. Since the coup d'etat last year, the aid had been halted, but the U.S. says it's resuming the military aid. One of Kerry's former colleagues in the Senate, Patrick Leahy, warned the harsh actions taken today against journalists is the latest descent towards despotism. So how is it the U.S. is restoring more than $500 million in military aid right now? From his home in Australia, Peter Gresta's father, Juris Gresta, said, "My son is not a criminal. Journalism is not a crime," echoing the sentiment that has gone global. A threat to the freedom of the press is a threat to the public's right to know. It's the flow of information, not the flow of military aid, that's essential to the functioning of a democratic society. I wanted to end with the words of someone far younger than I am and far wiser. And this is on a different issue than I've talked about tonight, but I think one that people here are deeply concerned about because it involves the fate of the planet. We need a media that's not brought to us by the weapons manufacturers when we talk about war. We need a media that's not brought to us by the oil, the gas, the coal, and the nuclear companies when we talk about climate change. And that's where I want to end, because this is where the hope is. You know, every year Democracy Now! Goes to the UN Climate Summit. Why? Not because of what happens inside, but it's the thousands of people who come from around the world, from the most devastated areas. I mean, the Pentagon recognizes that climate change is the greatest threat to the 21st century. They understand what will generate wars. Climate refugees, the lack of resources, disease caused by a baking planet. And we have to take this ever more seriously. So when we were in Durban, South Africa, we went to a final session. Here was a young person from a small school here in the United States, one I knew because I was a visiting student there myself, College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. There was a contingent of students from this school. And one of the students was named Anjali Apadurai. And she was chosen to give an address inside the conference, though so much of her work was outside. And I wanted to end with Anjali's words. Anjali got up before thousands of people and said, "I speak for more than half the world's population. We are the silent majority. You've given us a seat in this hall, but our interests are not on the table. What does it take to get a stake in this game? Lobbyists, corporate influence, money? You've been negotiating all of my life. In that time, you've failed to meet pledges, you've missed targets, you've broken promises, but you've heard this all before. We're in Africa. home to communities on the front line of climate change. The world's poorest countries need funding for adaptation now. The Horn of Africa needed it yesterday. But as 2012 dawns, our Green Climate Fund remains empty. The International Energy Agency tells us we have 5 years until the window to avoid irreversible climate change closes. The science tells us we have 5 years maximum. You're saying, give us 10. The most stark betrayal of your generation's responsibility to ours is that you call this ambition. Where is the courage in these rooms? Now is not the time for incremental action. In the long run, these will be seen as the defining moments of an era in which narrow self-interest prevailed over science, reason, and common compassion. There is real ambition in this room, but it's been dismissed as radical, deemed not politically possible. Stand with Africa. Long-term thinking is not radical. What's radical is to completely alter the planet's climate, to betray the future of my generation, and to condemn millions to death by climate change. What's radical is to write off the fact that change is within our reach. 2011 was the year in which the silent majority found their voice, the year when the bottom shook the top. 2011 was the year when the radical became reality. And she concluded, respect the foundational principles of this convention. Respect the integral values of humanity. Respect the future of your descendants. Mandela said, it always seems impossible until it's done. So, distinguished delegates and governments around the world, governments of the developed world, deep cuts now, get it done. And the head of the conference said, the chairperson said, thank you, Ms. Apaderai, who was speaking on behalf of half of the world's population, I think she said at the beginning. And on purely a personal note, said the chairperson, I wonder why we let not speak half the world's population first in this conference, but only last. But the fact of the matter is, we have independent media that can be a forum for people like Anjali and all of you, for people like Mandela, who was imprisoned for 27 years. Even his voice could not be heard, but his sentiments echoed all over the world, especially because there is independent media, which we must shore up for all of the different movements to give voice to the majority of people who probably feel very much like you do in this room. We need a media that acts as the fourth estate, not for the state. That actually covers power, not covers for power. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. Democracy Now!
Amy Goodman on individuals who made a difference and the importance of the alternative media. Thank you for listening to our own small contribution to the alternative media, New World Notes. Thanks also to the organization WeAreMany.org, which provided the original recordings of Amy Goodman's speech. I have edited and condensed that speech a little for radio broadcast. You can find an archive of New World Notes programs, plus pretty pictures and whatnot, at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimi non carborundum, and remember, the truth is out there. To find it, remember Howard Beale's advice.
Turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off right now, turn them off and leave them off.
Ciao.